over the last couple of months, many people have felt quite despondent when it comes to the elections in Ireland. And not just this general election, I suppose the previous European election as well. One man who's written a piece about this is Professor Seth Barrett-Tillman. And along with Daniel Epstein O'Dowd, they've written a piece talking about proportional representation, how it can and can fail, how good it is, how bad it is, what we could do to change it, what can we actually do about it. And it doesn't seem there's a lot we can actually do about it. But how do we get a system whereby we believe we have the right people in power and the people we actually want in power? Well, Seth joins me, and he is a law associate professor in Maynooth University of Law and Criminology. Seth, good afternoon to you.
Thanks so much for having me on, and I'm really looking forward to this opportunity to talk about my short article in the Irish Law Times that comes out later this month.
Okay, so if people want to read this, by the way, it comes out in the Irish Law Times, just to let people know, so you can read the whole piece. I have a draft of it here. But it is interesting because it very much focuses on proportional representation. Now, Seth, all I've been hearing from people both on radio and on the podcast over the last month and a half in particular is, we didn't vote for them lot. Why are they back in government again? And it comes down to our voting system and the way the system works. Explain for people who, first of all, proportional representation. I think Ireland and Malta are the only countries that have proportional representation. Do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, that's one of those difficult questions. It can be a good thing if you don't live in a country that's a national security state. If you live in a country like the United Kingdom during World War II, or most of U.S. history, where you want decisive majorities by having two-party elections, then I think proportional representation is a mistake. It leads to very vociferous, difficult coalitions with uneasy leaders who don't really get along with one another, and they're always looking forward to the next election without any real feelings of loyalty towards their working majority. On the other hand, if you live in a relatively benign or safe state, that you're not really afraid of invasion, and your biggest problem are some of your own people or people coming into your country with or without permission, then proportional representation, I would say, is much less risky. What I can say is there's a variety of different sorts of proportional representation around the world. Ireland's proportional representation is, I would say, unique in one aspect, which is that not only is it constituency-based, as opposed to one national constituency, not only is it constituency-based, but there's this obscure provision in the Irish Constitution that says every constituency has to have at least three members, as opposed to two members or one member. Where that provision came from, I don't know exactly. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of good records for the drafting of many of the provisions of the Irish Constitution. But certainly that aspect is unique. And I've often wondered if the reason for it was twofold, which was after the Civil War, each party wanted to make sure it wasn't shut out of all politics by narrowly losing the vast majority of seats, the way you can see in the United States or in Great Britain, that narrow majorities could carry almost all the seats. So proportional representation makes sure that minorities have at least a voice, even if they don't really have an element of control. That's the theory. Mm-hmm. I've often also suspected that another reason proportional representation was set up was to offer comfort to the Northern Ireland population, that should they come into Ireland, they would immediately be able to elect some of their people into the legislature, even if they're a declining population or a declining part of the country as a whole. That isn't the way it worked out population-wise. I'm just trying to explain why this provision might have been set up.
I mean, you give a good example in the paper about, you know, and I'm going to quote you here. It says, however, we should still recognise that in Kerry, over 13,000 votes are required for each candidate to reach the quota. Yet in the capital, Dublin, it takes only 6,500 votes in Dublin Central for a candidate to reach the quota. To most people looking from the outside in, that just seems barmy, doesn't it?
I think so. I think it's very unusual that people in this country don't really consider that. Let me put you this way. One of the things that I saw when moving to this country, I came here in 2011, is that the media and the well-informed public who follow politics are absolutely horrified when it can happen in the United States that a person who had a minority number of votes carried enough states that he wins, which is what happened to Trump in 2016. Those are the rules. And one of the reasons people are able to notice that is the American system, even though it has problems, is very transparent. Nobody reports in the press here what the vote breakdown is after an Irish election or after the coalition is formed. That is, there's no reporting how many votes and what percentage of votes the winning coalition got. And one reason that's not reported, except for the first preferences, one reason the actual votes are not reported, is it's very difficult to calculate. The system obscures accountability.
And that's I was in the system, Seth, and I still couldn't know. I'm standing there in the count center, you know, I don't know, I was on about the 10th or 15th count or something, and everybody was talking to me. There was a guy from Brussels who I'd made friends with, and he was seemingly an expert. He was a tally man. He was going around doing the tallies and everything else, and he was coming over to me, and he was saying to me, now, look, if Eoghan Reardon gets 5,000, you get 3,000, and if Regina Doherty gets 4,000, and I'm going, yeah? He said, you might just get the third seat. And I'm going, this is like being in a pub in Ireland during the World Cup, whereas if England lose by 2 and Germany win by 1 and we draw, we might just win. You know what I mean? And it just, to me, it's went straight over my head. It just seems so complicated. I'm going, but how is this working? You know what I mean? It just seemed so complicated.
I think that's one of the problems with it. One of the problems is there's a lack of transparency, where after an election and after a government's formed, there's no real effort to identify what share of the vote people got, except sometimes the newspapers report the first preferences distribution. So one of the things I try to do in my paper is I try to show what we should do is we should count the number of votes each candidate who received a TD seat, how many votes he was elected by after transfers. That is.
And a good example of that would have been in the last election, last general election, Leo Varadkar, of course, only got in on the last count. So there was probably somebody who got more first preference votes, but didn't get elected. I don't know for sure, but there probably was. And that seems unfair, doesn't it?
Well, I won't say it seems unfair. I just don't like the idea of these low quality votes after the fifth or sixth count where people really aren't giving it full thought to be so decisive. I would think that where there are 5 seats in the constituency, you should have 5 counts and then the 5 strongest candidates should win, because I really don't believe.
Then I would have got elected, by the way, if that had been the case.
But let me go back to the broader point. What this paper was in part about was trying to show that even though Ireland has proportional representation, because it's constituency-based, you're going to have some candidates who do relatively poorly and some who do relatively well, such as candidates who come in at the last count under quota. So you could imagine a situation of a government formed by a great many of these under-quota people, a very weak government, but it just might have more seats. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what happened with Trump in 2016. He had the votes in the right places. He didn't have a majority of the popular vote, but he won anyway. At least the American system is transparent. What could happen, what has happened in this country is that the bottom 94 candidates, I believe that was the number I used in my paper, would have less than 50% of the vote in the last Irish election. That is,
I think it was 97, actually, you said. Indeed, the 97 members of the Dáil elected with the fewest votes.
My mistake.
Yeah.
In other words, if the 97 weakest candidates got out of their own parties and formed a coalition, that would be less than 50% of the vote, but it would be more. It would be a 10-seat majority in the Dáil. Mm-hmm. So what part of this paper is there to show is that proportional representation is not a guarantee by any means of a majority mandate behind the elected government.
And it's not even a guarantee. It's not a guarantee of democracy, really, is it? Because, you know, Joey, you know, might get, you know, in on the 18 count or something like that, only because Mary voted for him, because she kind of went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Who am I going to give a last vote to? Ah, he looks nice. Yeah,
that's right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so.
I do. I think the use of low quality votes deep in the count might be a mistake, but that's a substantive issue that my paper didn't really deal with. I just wanted to.
I think that, you know, you are right. You are right. If we restricted it to 5 votes, let's just say 5 votes, that you're only allowed to give 5
five counts.
Well, and that would restrict the people. I would say, you know, let the electorate say you're only allowed to have 5 votes, you know, and then they would have to think a little bit harder because I've only got 5 to give away. So I'm going to give these away more cautiously. And there'll be only 5 counts as well, obviously. On that note, I think you would have a very different result to the result that we got.
It would be more like a two-party system, like in the United States or in Great Britain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it would be much more like that, and that might be good or it might be bad, depending how much you want to see big parties built up and small parties knocked down a bit. Then those small parties might have to reconglomerate with some of the bigger parties. So, look, I want to make another point, which I made in my paper, which is that there's this oddity in not only the Irish Constitution, but in many of the electoral systems around the world, that when setting up constituencies, constituencies are population-based. And it seems to me that made sense back in 1937 when people weren't moving into Ireland in large numbers. As a matter of fact, the experience of Ireland probably for the prior 100 years was people were only moving away. So people in Ireland really weren't thinking about this issue when setting up their constitution. I think it's a profound mistake to use the ratio being population to number of seats, which is the way the Irish constitution is set up. That is, if a constituency has three seats, then it has to have three times the population then. Let me rephrase that. If it has six seats, then mm-hmm. it has to have twice the population as a constituency with three seats. That is, there's a ratio between population and the number of seats with a minimum of at least three. The problem with that is if you live in a constituency with a large number of migrants or a large number of children, in other words, non-voters, it takes fewer Irish voters to elect members. And it strikes me that's terribly unfair. And mm-hmm. that's part of what you see in Kerry, where it takes 13,000 votes to make quota, where there probably aren't a lot of migrants. But in Dublin Central, where I think we have quite a few, it takes 6,500. And that is, in my view, very unfair. I'm not going to go as far as to say Barmy, because we have the exact same thing in the United States.
There's also a case, and I remember when I was campaigning, I went to certain areas of Dublin, and I'm going to be honest, what I did focus on, because obviously you can't do everywhere in the limited amount of time and space and money that you have, so I picked areas that voted no in the referendum, because I thought they're more likely to vote for me. So let's get out there. And now, I did go to Dunleary and the other places as well, which traditionally voted for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, but I did go there too, but for shorter periods of time. So I focused on places like, Ballyfermot, Ballymun, working class areas, Colesters, Howth, Edenmore, where I came from. But what I had noticed was I topped the poll in Clondalkin, right? So I got the most amounts of votes in Clondalkin. But I would have got a lot more, only for the fact that a very few people in Clondalkin actually vote. But yet everybody you meet say, oh, I'll give you a vote, Niall, I'll give you a vote, Niall, I'll give you a vote, Niall. But many of those people who say that don't actually vote. They don't have a vote. They've never been registered to vote. They haven't bothered to register to vote because they feel abandoned. They feel like there's no point in voting because the same people get in over and over again. So they have that kind of feeling in their head. So, would you agree with a system, and I talked about this on the radio, whereby people had to vote? I.e., if you didn't vote, there was a fine. I know they do that in Australia. In some countries, yes, exactly. In some countries, they actually ban you from, say, for 5 years for voting if you don't vote, unless you have a good reason, of course. Would you agree with a kind of system like that, a compulsory voting system?
I haven't given that issue a lot of thought, but I tend to think that would be a mistake, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you make voters show up, a lot of them are going to be spiteful
and spoil the votes.
Like showing up. If you're lucky, they might spoil the election, by violence at the polls or things along those lines. Or voting for candidates that they know are, frankly dangerous to send a message. And I think we sort of saw something like
this. We kind of did.
I don't want to name any.
No, you don't have to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Of course, many people would say that about the United States, too, but I'm not one of them. I understand what you're saying. It would be better if there was a better effort by both the parties and the civil service to go into neighborhoods and to make active efforts to register people. I think that would help. But the fact is, even if you register people, that doesn't mean they're going to show up on election day.
Because wasn't that the big thing for Trump during the elections in the last 2 months was, sending people out there to register people to vote. So that was the big thing. That's, part of what got him over the line and got him those extra few million votes, in the popular vote. But in saying that, here in Ireland, there are parts of Dublin in particular where the voters or the voting level is down to 25%. Like, that's appalling. That's not democracy, is it?
Do you mean 20? Do you mean 25% of the population or 25% of the voters?
25% of the voters not turning up.
Wow, that is.
Yeah, are turning up, should I say?
Appalling. Yeah, that is appalling. But again, I'm not sure that making it mandatory is the best solution. I think there are real downside consequences to that. But there's nothing wrong with a little of experimentation. You might try council elections for a few years, doing that, not the whole nation, but in a few places, and seeing how it works out for you.
Or even a presidential election where it doesn't really matter too much who gets in, I suppose.
You might do it where the idea is popular. So if it goes wrong, the people brought it on themselves rather than it was forced from the national parties in Dublin and people feel, you know, evicted from their tradition, so to speak.
People in Ireland feel, and again, we're coming back to proportional representation and everything you've explained, and you explained it really well. And I have to say, it's explained really well in the paper too, how the whole system works and how you can see the flaws in it. And also you can see the good bits too. But, you know, to people, over the last, as I said, month and a half on the intro there, I mentioned, they feel really despondent at the moment when it comes to, and I get their feeling. I'm not saying all the parties are bad, or who's bad or who's good or whatever it is, but they kind of feel, what's the point? It's just the same again. It's just the same again. It doesn't matter who we vote for. It's just the same again. And that's the way they feel. And it's kind of hard to get that feeling out of their head, isn't it?
It doesn't have to be that way. It only takes a few people working persistently to change things. Mm-hmm. Now, whether those changes are desirable or not is something we could talk about. I think one reason things don't change in Ireland is about half this country likes the FFFG coalition, and that's why they vote for them. They're not despondent. That's what they want.
Are they like my dad, who used to vote for Fianna Fáil no matter what happened?
I think. You know, look, I mean, Nigel Farage in Britain ran for parliament seven times and lost, and yet Brexit happened anyway. I'm not saying Brexit was right or wrong. I'm simply saying.
Yeah, but he was very instrumental in that. Yes, of course.
Right. The persistence of a few people over a long time can prevail to change things, but you've got to really want that persistence and you've got to be willing to work for it. Mm-hmm. So. You know, I understand that there are a lot of people in this country who are despondent. I get that. But those people are going to be on, to be blunt about it, every side of the political spectrum. There's going to be a lot of leftists who want more Paul Murphy. And there are going to be a lot of people from the other side of the political spectrum who want something much further to the right than FFFG.
But here's the thing about Irish politics, right? You can have extreme leftists, right? And you mentioned Paul Murphy there a few minutes ago, of course, people before profit, social democrats, who I consider to be extreme leftists. We heard last night on TV the social democrats calling for people to be able to serve their sentences within their community, in their homes, which I thought was the most barmy idea that most people wouldn't agree with. Anyway, so you can have the extreme leftists in government, you can have the centrists, and then but there is no... The centrists and the current government who leans slightly to the left, okay? So it's left of centre, okay? But there is no such thing as right of centre. There's no such thing as the centrist who's a little bit conservative and doesn't agree with some of the stuff. You're either centrist or you're an extreme right. Do you understand? There is nothing in the middle. Whereas on the left, there is something in the middle. And on the left, you're not a bad person. But if you're on the right, you're a bad person.
What you're saying isn't unique to Ireland. It's a worldwide phenomenon, and it's not just in politics. It's in lots of other elements of civil society. Mm-hmm. But, you know, look, I mean, Trump's going to try to change that in the United States. Whether that's good or bad is something we could argue about, but he's one man who set his sights against the status quo. Mm-hmm. And if you find people like that in this country, perhaps yourself, again, running, then maybe there'll be an opportunity to do those things that you want to do. Look, isn't one reason the status quo is so powerful in this country that many ministers in any Irish government have their eyes on being a commissioner in the EU? Mm. And that means that
absolutely
they can't do anything to rock the boat institutionally. Right?
So in other words, they're working for Europe. It's jobs for the boys, isn't it? It always has been.
I wouldn't put it quite that way. I would simply say that their interests are not fully aligned with the voters, is the way I put it. That is, if they're thinking about the next job rather than the job they've got, and the voters who put them there, that's a problem. And look, this is one reason so many in the United States, particularly in the Republican Party, are unhappy with international institutions. Their attitude is, look, I take the time to elect and pay for a Congress. I want you to work for us. I don't want you to take instructions from any international bodies. And that's that. Mm-hmm. Now, in Ireland and in many small countries, international institutions are an opportunity for small countries to have more influence than they'd otherwise have, even if those international bodies aren't particularly democratic, right? So that's one reason you constantly hear Irish politicians and politicians in other smaller countries saying, we have to support this EU institution, we have to support this EU reform, this EU commission, because we're one of our people's a commissioner, and we're such a small country that if it was democratic in the normal sense of the word, we would never dream of having equal representation on the commission where every country in the EU has one commissioner. It would just never happen.
Just finally, in relation to your paper, people, by the way, can read your paper. It goes into the Irish Law Times. You're kind of getting a preview of it here today. But essentially, you don't really come to a conclusion. I don't expect to see you don't have the answers for everything. What is the answer to our failed system? Well, when I say I'm saying our failed system, you're not. But what is the answer to that?
Look, I put forward one small reform that isn't going to solve everything, but I think it would be a good first step, which if the ratio between seats in a constituency
and counts,
instead of using population, constituencies were divided up by number of Irish voters, or people who are permitted to vote in Irish national elections, such as British people living in Ireland, where everyone had a vote of equal value, or of equal proportion. I think you might have slightly more interest in elections and slightly more activity. I think part of the difficulty here is that you have people outside of Dublin and Cork, you know, in the Midlands, out in the west of Ireland, who, you know, those people are vastly underrepresented in a sense, because everyone who lives out there, not every last person, but the vast majority, are Irish people and Irish voters. And their vote, in a certain sense, is being watered down by constituencies in the two big cities, and maybe the three or four big cities, counting. We'd have to get some – by constituencies that a big share of the population are non-voters, such as migrants and such as children.
Yeah.
And I think that's a mistake. I think it's very unfair. I'd like the same reform in the United States. It's been quietly talked about in the United States for some years, to shift from population-based apportionment of congressional seats towards voter base. But it's very difficult to change the U.S. Constitution. I mean, one of the funny things that's not quite properly understood in Ireland, I think, is that the United States Constitution, by most metrics, is the most difficult to amend constitution in the world. Since 1788, there have only been 27 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, and 10 of them were in the first 2 years. So in basically 250 years of American history, there have only been 17 amendments. Whereas I think Ireland's already in the 40s, and your constitution came in 1937. It's really easy to get a constitutional amendment relative to other constitutional systems. So if people are unhappy with the system the way it is, maybe one thing they could do is change the way seats are constructed, or constituencies are constructed. Instead of using a population base, they should use a voter base, the number of registered voters in the constituency. That would be a good first step. And if we do that, we could talk about a second step.
Well, when the next step comes, we'll talk about that too. It's been an interesting conversation. Professor Seth Barrett-Tillman from Newt University, thank you very much indeed for joining me today. It's very interesting because I know there's a lot of people around the country who still don't understand proportional representation. And as I said to you, I was in the system. I was running into the system, and there was times I didn't understand it. I was still there. I was in the RDS. I said to my campaign manager at one stage, what does that mean? And she'd be going, well, if he's out, you'll get his votes. But I said, but will they not go to him? And she said, yeah, but people who might have given you a fifth preference on his will go to you because they're, those other three are already gone. And I go, what are you saying to me? That's a, it just, it's mind blowing. You know, and I know the people who are counting obviously understand it. But I certainly didn't. You know what I mean? It just gets complicated.
It's more complicated than it should be. As a matter of fact, in the last election, there was one constituency when there was a dispute about the order at which the counts were made and about when undercounts would be transferred and when overcounts would be transferred. And it led to a delay in the announced results, I think, for several
years. That's right.
That constituency. You know, so it's not. It's really not so obvious. I mean, I'll give you an example of one of the difficulties, the administrative difficulties with proportional representation. From what I understand, the way proportional representation is administratively run for MEP elections in this country is in fact different from the way proportional representation is run for TD elections. But if you were to ask the average Irish person, is that true? They'd look at you like you have three heads.
What, I'm looking at you like you have three heads now because I didn't even know that.
That's right. And in fact, there are differences with the way the elections are counted and the way the counts proceed. Now, there might be practical reasons for that because the MEP seats are so relatively large. So perhaps there's justification for that. But it's completely unknown to the voters. It's completely unknown probably to the government. And the more this stuff is hidden, probably the more people will be despondent. And that's one of the benefits of having a simple two-party system. I'm not saying you should, by law, you should have only two parties. But when you have winner-take-all by plurality or by majority, you'll have probably two dominant parties, and that makes transparency easier.
What do you think, Seth? Should I go to the papers tomorrow and say, the election was rigged, I want a recount, I should be in Europe? I don't think that would work. I don't think a Donald Trump would work for me.
I don't think it would work, yes.
No, not at all. But look, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Professor Seth Barrett-Tillman. Thank you very much indeed, and I appreciate you coming on to talk to us about clearing all that up today. And people want to read more, by the way, it's in the paper, it'll be in the Irish Law Times. When will it be in the Irish Law Times for them to have a look at it?
It should come out on or about January 31st this year.
Okay. Listen, thank you very much indeed, Seth.
Bye-bye. Thank you.